Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. My Enemy's Enemy by Kingsley Amis. Yes, I know all about that, Tom, the adjutant said through a mouthful of stew. But technical qualifications aren't everything. There's other sides to a signal officer's job, you know, especially while we're still pretty well static. The communications are running themselves, and we don't want to start getting complacent. My personal view is, and has been from the word go, that your friend Dally's a standing bloody reproach to this unit, never mind how much he knows about the 6th channel and the other boxes of tricks. That's a lineman mechanic job anyway, not an officer's. And I can tell you for a fact, I mean to do something about it, do you see? He laid down his knife, though not his fork, and took 3 or 4 swallows of wine. Well, your boy Cleaver doesn't impress me all that much, Bill, Thurston, who hated the adjutant, said to him. The only time we've tried him on duty, he flapped. Just inexperience, Tom, the adjutant said. He'd soon snap out of that if we gave him command of the section. Sergeant Beach would carry him until he found his feet. I'd like to see that, I must say. The line duty officer getting his sergeant out of bed to hold his hand while he changes a valve. Now look here, old boy. The adjutant levered a piece of meat out from between 2 teeth and ate it. You know as well as I do that young Cleaver's got the best technical qualifications of anyone in the whole unit. It's not his fault he's been stuck on office work ever since he came to us. There's a fellow that's smarting up that bunch of goons and long-haired, bloody mathematical wizards they call a line maintenance section. As it is, the NCOs don't chase the blokes, and Dally isn't interested in chasing the NCOs. Isn't interested in anything but his bloody circuit diagrams and test frames and what have you. To cover his irritation, Thurston summoned the mess corporal, who stood by the wall in a posture that compromised between that of an attendant waiter and the regulation stand-at-ease position. The adjutant had schooled him in mess procedure, though not in mess etiquette. "Gin and lime, please, Gordon. Just as well, in a way, he is interested in line apparatus, isn't it, Bill? We'd have looked pretty silly without him during the move out of Normandy and across France. He worked as hard as any 2 of the rest of us, and as well. He got his bouquet from the colonel, didn't he? I don't grudge him that. I admit he did good work then. Not as good as some of his chaps, probably, but still, he served his turn. Yes, that's exactly it, Tom. He served his... According to Major Rylands, he was the linchpin of the whole issue, Thurston said, lighting a cigarette with fingers that were starting to tremble. And I'm prepared to take his word for it. The war isn't over yet, you know. Christ knows what may happen in the spring. If Dally isn't around to hold the line maintenance end up for Rylands, the whole unit might end up in a mess with the staff jumping on its back. Cleaver might be all right, I agree. We just can't afford to take the risk. This was an unusually long speech for anyone below the rank of major to make in the adjutant's presence. Temporarily gagged by a mouthful of stew, the officer was eating as fast as he could and shaking his forefinger to indicate that he would as soon as possible propose some decisive amendment to what he had just been told. With his other hand, he scratched the crown of his glossy black head, looking momentarily like a tic-tac man working through his lunch break. He said indistinctly, "You're on to the crux of the whole thing, old boy. Rylands is the root of all the trouble. Bad example at the top, do you see?" Swallowing, he went on. If the second-in-command goes round looking like a latrines detail and calling the blokes by their Christian names, what can you expect? You can't get away from it. Familiarity breeds contempt. Trouble with him is he thinks he's still working in the post office. A hot foam of anger seemed to fizz up in Thurston's chest. Major Rylands is the only field officer in this entire unit who knows his job. It is due to him and Dally, plus Sergeant Beach and the lineman Mex, that our line communications have worked so smoothly during this campaign. To them and to no one else. If they can go on doing that, they can walk about with bare arses for all I care. The adjutant frowned at Thurston. After running his tongue round his upper teeth, he said, "You seem to forget, Tom, that I'm responsible for the discipline of officers in this unit." He paused to let the other reflect on the personal implications of this, then nodded to where Corporal Gordon was approaching with Thurston's drink. As he signed the chit, Thurston was thinking that Gordon had probably been listening to the conversation from the passage. If so, he would probably discuss it with Hill, the colonel's batman, who would probably report it to his master. It was often said, especially by Lieutenant D'Alessio, the Dally now under discussion, that the colonel's chief contact with his unit was through the rumors and allegations Hill, and to a less extent the adjutant, took to him. A tweak of disquiet made Thurston drink deeply and resolve to say no more for a bit. The adjutant was brushing crumbs off his battle dress, which was of the greenish hue current in the Canadian Army. This little affectation, like the gamboge gloves and the bamboo walking stick, perhaps suited a man who'd helped to advertise men's clothes in civilian life. He went on to say in his rapid, quacking monotone, "I'd advise you, Tom, not to stick your neck out too far in supporting a man who's going to be out of this unit on his ear before very long." "Ryland, you mean?" "No, no, no. Unfortunately not. But Dally's going." "That's Jen, is it?" "Not yet, but it will be." "I don't follow you." The adjutant looked up in Gordon's direction, then leaned forward across the table to Thurston. "It only needs one more thing," he said quietly, "to turn the scale. The CO has been watching Dally for some time on my suggestion. I know the old man pretty well, as you know, after being in his company for 3 years at North Midland Command. He's waiting to make up his mind, do you see? If Dally puts up a black in the near future, a real black, that'll be enough for the CO. Cleaver'll get his chance at last." "Suppose Dally doesn't put up a black?" "He will." "He hasn't yet, you know. The terminal equipment's all on the top line, and Dally knows it inside out." "I'm not talking about that kind of a black. I'm talking about the administrative and disciplinary side. Those vehicles of his are in shocking condition. I thought of working a snap 406 inspection on one of them, but that wouldn't look too good. Too much like discrimination. But there'll be something. Just give me time." Thurston thought of saying that those vehicles, though covered with months-old mud and otherwise offensive to the inspecting eye, were in good running order, thanks to the efficiency of the section's transport corporal. Instead, he let his mind wander back to one of the many stories of the colonel's spell as a company commander in England. 3 weeks running, he had presented his weekly prize of £1 for the smartest vehicle to the driver of an obsolete wireless truck immobilized for lack of spare parts. The company sergeant major had won a bet about it. "We'll have some fun then, Tom, old boy," the adjutant was saying in as a festive a tone as his voice allowed. He was unaware that Thurston disliked him. His own feelings towards Thurston were a mixture of respect and patronage. Respect for Thurston's Oxford degree in accent, job at a minor public school, and competence as a non-technical officer. Patronage for his practice of reading literary magazines and for his vaguely scholarly manner and appearance. The affinity between Thurston's unmilitary look and the more frankly ragamuffin demeanor of D'Alessio could hardly explain, the adjutant wonderingly felt, the otherwise unaccountable tendency of the one to defend the other. It was true that they'd known each other at the officers' training unit at Catterick, but what could that have to do with it? The adjutant was unaccustomed to having his opinions contested, and he now voiced the slight bafflement that had been growing on him for the last few minutes. "It rather beats me," he said, "why you're taking this line about friend Dally. You're not at all thick with him. In fact, he seems to needle you whenever he speaks to you. My impression is, old boy, for what it's worth, you've got no bloody use for him at all, and yet you stick up for him. Why?" Thurston amazed him by saying coldly, "I don't see why the fact that a man's an Italian should be held against him when he does his job as well as anyone in the sodding army." "Just a minute, Tom," the adjutant said, taking a cigarette from his silver case, given to him by his mistress in Brussels. "That's being a bit unfair, you know. You never heard me say a word about D'Alessio being an eye tie. Never. You were the one who brought it up. It makes no difference to me if a fellow's father's been interned, provided—" "Uncle." "All right, uncle, then. As I say, that's no affair of mine. Presumably he's okay from that point of view, or he'd never have got here. And that's all there is to it, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not holding it against him, not for a moment. I don't quite know where you picked up that impression, old boy." Thurston shook his head, blushing slightly. "Sorry, Bill," he said. "I must have got it mixed. It used to get on my wick at Cataract, and the way some of the blokes took it out of him about his pal Musso and so on. I suppose it must be through that somehow. In a way, I keep feeling people have got it in for him on that score. Sorry. He was not sorry. He knew quite certainly that his charge was well-founded and that the other's silence about D'Alessio's descent was a matter of circumspection only. If anyone in the mess admired Mussolini, Thurston suspected, it was the adjutant, although he kept quiet about that as well. It was tempting to dig at his prejudices on these and other questions, but Thurston did his best never to succumb to that temptation. The adjutant's displeasure was always strongly urged and sometimes, rumor said, followed up by retaliatory persecution. Enough, dangerously much, had already been said in D'Alessio's defense. The adjutant's manner had grown genial again, and with a muttered apology he now offered Thurston a cigarette. "What about another of those?" he asked, pointing his head at Thurston's glass. "Thank you, I will, but I must be off in a minute. We're opening that teleprinter to the polls at 2000, and I want to see it's working." Two more officers now entered the mess dining room. They were Captain Bentham, a 40-year-old regular soldier who had been a company sergeant major in India at the outbreak of war, and Captain Rowney, who, besides being in charge of the unit's administration, was also the mess's catering officer. Rowney nodded to Thurston and grinned at the adjutant, whose Canadian battle dress he had been responsible for securing. He himself was wearing a sheepskin jacket made on the Belgian black market. "Hello, William," he said. "Won the war yet?" Although he was a great chum of the adjutant's, some of his remarks to him, Thurston had noticed, carried a curious vein of satire. Bentham sat stolidly down a couple of places along the table, running his hands over his thin gray hair. "Tom and I have been doing a little plotting," the adjutant said. "We've decided a certain officer's career with this unit needs terminating." Bentham glanced up casually and caught Thurston's eye. This, coming on top of the adjutant's misrepresentation of the recent discussion, made Thurston feel slightly uncomfortable. That was ludicrous, because he had long ago written Bentham off as of no particular account, as a most uninteresting type of regular army ex-ranker, good only at cable-laying, supervising cable-laying, and looking after the men who did the actual cable-laying. Despite this, Thurston found himself saying, "It wasn't quite like that," but at that moment Rowney asked the adjutant a question, and the protest, mild as it was, went unheard. "Your friend Dally, of course," the adjutant answered Rowney. "Why, what's he been up to?" Bentham asked in his slow Yorkshire voice. "Having his hair cut?" There was a general laugh, then a token silence while Gordon laid plates of stew in front of the new arrivals. His inquiry whether the adjutant wanted any rice pudding was met with a facetious and impracticable instruction for the disposal of that foodstuff by an oft-quoted route. "Can't you do better than that, Jack?" the adjutant asked Rowney. "Third night we've had Chinese wedding cake this week." "Sorry, William. My Belgian friends had a little misunderstanding with the civvy police. I'm still looking round for another pal with the right views on how the officers of a liberating army should be fed. Just possess your soul and patience." "What's this about Dally?" Bentham persisted. "If there's a move to give him a wash and a change of clothes, count me in." Thurston got up before the topic could be reopened. "By the way, Jack," he said to Rowney, "young Malone asked me to remind you that he still hasn't had those cigarettes for the blokes he's lent to Special Wireless." Rowney sighed. "Tell him it's not my pigeon, will you, Thomas? I've been into it all with him. They're under Special Wireless for everything now." "Not NAAFI rations. He told me you'd agreed to supply them. Up until last week. They're off my hands now." "Oh, no, they're not," Thurston said nastily. "According to Malone, they still haven't had last week's." "Well, tell him." "Look, Jack, you tell him. It's nothing to do with me, is it?" Rowney stared at him. "All right, Thomas," he said, abruptly diving his fork into his stew. "I'll tell him." Dodging the hanging lampshade, which at its lowest point was no more than 5 feet from the floor, Thurston hurried out, his greatcoat over his arm. "What's eating our intellectual friend?" Rowney asked. The adjutant rubbed his blue chin. "Don't know quite. He was behaving rather oddly before you blokes came in. He's getting too sort of wrapped up in himself. Needs shaking up. He was just deciding, having previously decided against it, to inflict some small but salutary injustice on Thurston through the medium of unit orders. He might compel the various sections to start handing in their store records for check, beginning with Thurston's section and stopping after it. Nice, but perhaps a bit too drastic. What about pinching his Jeep for some tiresome extra duty? That might be just the thing. If you ask me, Benton was saying, he's too bloody stuck up by half. Wants a lesson of some kind, he does. You're going too far there, Ben, the adjutant said decisively. He disliked having Bentham in the officer's mess, declaring its tone to be thereby lowered, and often said he thought the old boy would be much happier back in the sergeant's mess with people of his own type. Tom Thurston's about the only chap round here you can carry on a reasonable, intelligent discussion with. Bentham, unabashed, broke off a piece of bread and ran it round his plate in a way that Thurston and the adjutant were, unknown to each other, united in finding unpleasant. "What's all this about a plot about Dally?" he asked. "You got that, Reg?" D'Alessio asked. "If you get any more interference on this circuit, put it back on plain speech straight away. Then they can see how they like that. I don't believe for a bloody moment the line's been relayed for a single bastard yard. Still, it's being ceased in a week or two, and it never was of the slightest importance, so there's no real worry. Now, what about the gallant Poles?" He spoke with a strong Glamorganshire accent diversified by an occasional Italian vowel. "They're still on here, Reg," the lineman mechanic said, gesturing toward the test teleprinter. "Want to see 'em?" "Yes, please. It's nearly time to switch 'em through to the teleprinter room. We'll get that done before I go." Reg bent to the keyboard of the machine and typed, "How you getting on there? Reading me okay? K-K-K-K?" There was a humming pause while Reg scratched his armpit and said, "Gone for a piss, I expect. Ah, here he is." In typical but indistinguishably eerie fashion, the teleprinter took on a life of its own, performed a carriage return, moved the glossy white paper up a couple of lines, and typed, "For Christ's sake, quit bothering me. Not 2000 hours yet. K-K-K. D'Alessio, grinning to himself, shoved Rudge out of the way and typed, "Chief Signal Officer, British Liberation Army, ear. Watch your language, my man. K-K-K-K. Without hesitation, the distant operator typed, "You go and screw yourself, Jack. Sorry, I mean, sir." At this, D'Alessio went into roars of laughter, digging his knuckle into one deep eye socket and throwing back his large, dark head. It was exactly the kind of joke he liked best. He rotated a little in the narrow aisle between the banks of apparatus and test panels, still laughing, while Reg watched him with a slight smile. At last, D'Alessio recovered and shouldered his way down to the phone at the other end of the vehicle. "Give me the teleprinter room, please." "What? Who? All right, I'll speak to him." "Terminal equipment, D'Alessio here." "Yes." "Oh, really? It hasn't?" His voice changed completely, became that of a slightly unbalanced uncle commiserating with a disappointed child. "Now, isn't that just too bad? Well, I do think that's hard lines. Just when you were all excited about it, too, eh?" Over his shoulder he squealed to Reg in soprano parody of Thurston's educated tones, "Captain Thurston is terribly grieved that he hasn't got his pointer to the Poles yet. He's afraid we've got some horrid screen on over here to deprive him of it. All right, Thurston, I'll come over." "Yes, now." Reg smiled again and put a cigarette in his mouth, striking the match from long habit on the metal no-smoking notice tacked up over the ventilator. "Give me one of those, Reg. I want to cool my nerves before I go into the beauty parlor across the way." "Thanks. Now listen. Switch the Poles through to the teleprinter room at 7:58 exactly, so that there's working communication at 8, but not before. Do Thurston good to bite his nails for a few minutes. Put it through on number..." His glance and forefinger went momentarily to a test frame across the aisle. "Number 6. That's just been rewired. Ring up teleprinters and tell 'em, will you? See you before I go off." It was dark and cold outside, and D'Alessio shivered on his way over to the signal office. He tripped up on the cable, which ran shin-high between the line of blue and white posts outside the entrance, and applied an unclean expression to the adjutant who had had this amenity provided in an attempt to dignify the working area. Inside the crowded, brilliantly lighted office, he was half asphyxiated by the smoke from the stove and half deafened by the thumping of date stamps, the ringing of telephones, the enraged bark of one sergeant, and the loud, tremulous singing of the other. A red-headed man was rushing about bawling, "Emergency ops for Z-Corps," in the accents of County Cork. Nobody took any notice of him. They had all dealt with far too many emergency ops messages in the last 8 months. Thurston was in his office, a small room partitioned off from the main one. The unit was occupying what had once been a Belgian military school and later an SS training establishment. This building had obviously formed part of the original barrack area, and Thurston often wondered what whim of the adjutants had located the offices and stores down here, and the men's living quarters in former offices and stores. The cubicle, where Thurston spent so much of his time, had no doubt been the abode of the cadet, and then Unteroffizier in charge of barrack room. He was fond of imagining the heavily built Walloons and high-cheeked Prussians who had slept in here, and had insisted on preserving as a historical document the chalked Wir kommen zurück on the plank wall. Unlike his predecessors, he fancied he felt cut off from all the life going on just outside the partition, somehow isolated. Alone, without any company, he used to quote to himself. He would laugh then, sometimes, and go on to think of the unique lavatory at the far end of the building, where the defecator was required to plant his feet on two metal plates, grasp two handles, and curve his body into the shape of a bow over a kind of trough. He was not laughing now. His phone conversation with D'Alessio had convinced him, even more thoroughly than phone conversations with D'Alessio commonly did, that the other despised him for his lack of technical knowledge and took advantage of it to irritate and humiliate him. He tried to reread a letter from one of the two married women in England with whom, besides his wife, he was corresponding, but the thought of seeing D'Alessio still troubled him. Actually, seeing D'Alessio troubled him even more. Not for the first time it occurred to him that D'Alessio's long, matted hair, grease-spotted cylindrical trouser legs, and ill-fitting battle-dress blouse were designed as an offensive burlesque of his own neat but irremediably civilian appearance. He was smoking, too, and Thurston himself was punctilious in observing inside his office the rule that prohibited smoking on duty until 10 at night, but it was no use telling him to put it out. D'Alessio, he felt, never obeyed orders unless it suited him. "Hullo, Thurston," he said amiably. "Not still having a baby about the poles, I hope. I don't think I ever was I? I just wanted to make sure what the position was." "Oh, you wanted to make sure of that, did you? All right, then. It's quite simple. Physically, the circuit remains unchanged, of course. But, as you know, we have ways of providing extra circuits by means of electrical apparatus, notably by utilizing the electron-radiating properties of the thermionic valve or vacuum tube, if a signal is applied to the grid." Thurston's phone rang, and he picked it up gratefully. "Signal master," said the voice of Brigadier the Lord Fawcett, the largest and sharpest thorn in the side of the entire signals unit. "I want a special dispatch rider to go to Brussels for me. Will you send him round to my office for briefing in 10 minutes? Thurston considered. Apart from its being over 100 miles to Brussels, he suspected that the story told by previous special DRs who had been given this job was probably quite true. The purpose of the trip was to take in the brigadier's soiled laundry and bring back the clean stuff, plus any wines, spirits, and cigars that the brigadier's Brussels agent, an RASC colonel at the headquarters of the Reserve Army Corps, might have got together for him. But he could hardly ask the Lord Fawcett to confirm this. Why was it that his army career seemed littered with such problems? "The regular DR run goes out at 0500, sir," he said in a conciliatory tone. "Would that do instead, perhaps?" "No, it certainly would not do instead. You have a man available, I take it?" "Oh, yes, sir." This was true. It was also true that the departure of this man with the dirty washing would necessitate another, who might have been driving all day, being got out of the section billet and condemned, at best, to a night on the signal office floor, more likely to a run half across Belgium in the small hours with a genuine message of some kind. Yes, we have a man." "Well, I'm afraid in that case I don't see your difficulty. Get him round to me right away, will you?" "Very good, sir." There was never anything one could do. "Who was that?" D'Alessio asked when Thurston had rung off. "Brigadier Fawcett," Thurston said unguardedly, but Dally probably didn't know about the laundry rumor. He had little to do with the dispatch rider sections. "Oh, the washerwoman's friend. I heard a bit about that from Beach. Not on the old game again, is he? Sounded as if he wanted a special DR to me." "Yes, he did," Thurston raised his voice. "Prosser!" "Sir," came from outside the partition. "Ask Sergeant Baker to come and see me, will you?" "Sir." D'Alessio's large pale face became serious. He pulled at his mustache. Eventually he said, "You're letting him have one, are you?" If asked his opinion of Thurston, he would have described him as a plausible bastard. His acquiescence in such matters as this, D'Alessio would have added, was bloody typical. "I can't do anything else." "I would. There's nothing to it. Get God's adjutant on the blower and complain. He's an ignorant bloody oaf, we know, but I bet he'd take this up." Thurston had tried this only to be informed at length that the job of signals was to give service to the staff. Before he could tell D'Alessio about it, Baker, the DR sergeant, arrived to be acquainted with the Lord Fawcett's desires. Thurston thought he detected a glance of protest and commiseration pass between the other two men. When Baker had gone, he turned on D'Alessio almost savagely and said, "Now look, Dally, leaving aside the properties of the thermionic bleeding valve, would you kindly put me in the picture about this teleprinter to the poles? Is it working or isn't it? Quite a bit of stuff has piled up for them, and I've been holding it in the hope the line'll be through on time." "No harm in hoping," D'Alessio said. "I hope it'll be working all right, too." He dropped his fag end on the swept floor and trod on it. "Is it working or is it not?" Thurston asked very loudly. His eyes wandered up and down the other's fat body, remembering how it had looked in a pair of shorts doing physical training at the officer's training unit. It had proved incapable of the simplest tasks laid upon it, crumpling feebly in the forward roll exercise, hanging like a crucified sack from the wall bars, climbing by slow and ugly degrees over the vaulting horse. Perhaps its owner had simply not felt like exerting it. That would have been bloody typical. Before D'Alessio could answer, a knock came at the plywood door Thurston had made for his cubicle. In response to the latter's bellow, the red-headed man came in. "Sergeant Fleming sent to tell you, sir," he said. "We're just after getting them Polish fellows on the printer. You'll be wanting me to start sending off the messages we have for them, will you, sir?" Both Thurston and D'Alessio looked up at the traveling clock that stood on a high shelf in the corner. It said 8 o'clock. "That's just about all, gentlemen," the colonel said, "except for one last point. Now that our difficulties from the point of view of communication have been removed, and the whole show's going quite smoothly, there are other aspects of our work which need attention. This unit has certain traditions I want kept up. One of them, of course, is an absolutely 100% degree of efficiency in all matters affecting the disposal of signals traffic, from the time the in-clerk signs for a message from the staff to the time we get..." "He means the out-clerk," Thurston thought to himself. The little room where the officers, warrant officers, and senior NCOs of the unit held their conferences was unheated, and the colonel was wearing his knee-length sheepskin coat, another piece of merchandise supplied through the good offices of Jack Rowney, in exchange, perhaps, for a few gallons of petrol or a couple of hundred cigarettes. Malone's men's cigarettes, probably. The coat, added to the CO's platinum-blonde hair and mustache, increased his resemblance to a polar bear. Thurston was in a good mood, having just received the letter which finally buttoned up arrangements for his forthcoming leave. 4 days with Denise in Oxford, and then a nice little run up to town for 5 days with Margot. Just the job. He began composing a nature note on the polar bear. "This animal, although of poor intelligence, possesses considerable cunning of a low order. It displays the utmost ferocity when menaced in any way. It shows fantastic patience in pursuit of its prey and a vindictiveness which..." The colonel was talking now about another tradition of his unit, its almost unparalleled soldier-like quality, its demonstration of the verity that a signals formation of any kind was not a collection of down-at-heel scientists and long-haired mathematical wizards. Thurston reflected it was not for nothing that the adjutant so frequently described himself as the colonel's staff officer. Yes, there he was, Arctic Fox, or, if they had them, Arctic Jackal, smiling in proprietary fashion at his chief's oratory. What a bunch they all were. Most of the higher-ranking ones had been lower-ranking officers in the Territorial Army during the 30s. The colonel, for instance, a captain, the adjutant, a second lieutenant. The war had given them responsibility and quick promotion, and their continued enjoyment of such privileges rested not on their own abilities, but on those of people who had arrived in the unit by a different route. Post office engineers, whipped in with a commission, older regular soldiers promoted from the ranks, officers who had been the conscripts of 1940 and 1941. Yes, what a bunch. Thurston remembered the parting words of a former sergeant of his who had been posted home a few months previously. Now I'm going. I suppose I can say what I shouldn't. You never had a dog's bloody chance in this lot unless you'd been at North Midland Command with the Adj and the CO. And we all know it's the same in that mess of yours. If you'd been in the TA like them, you were a blue-eyed boy. Otherwise, you'd had it from the start. It's all right, sir. Everybody knows it. No need to deny it. The exception to the rule, presumably, was Cleaver, now making what was no doubt a shorthand transcript of the colonel's harangue. Thurston hated him as the adjutant's blue-eyed boy, and also for his silky hair, his Hitler youth appearance, and his thunderous laugh. His glance moved to Bentham, also busily writing. Bentham, too, fitted into the picture as much as the adjutant would let him, which was odd when compared with the attitude of other regulars in the mess. But Bentham had less individuality than they. "So what I propose," the colonel said, "is this. Beginning next week, the adjutant and I will be making a series of snap inspections of section barracks rooms. Now, I don't expect anything in the nature of spit and polish, of course. Just ordinary soldierly cleanliness and tidiness is all I want." In other words, just ordinary spit and polish, Thurston thought, making a note for his sergeant on his pad just below the polar bear vignette. He glanced up and saw D'Alessio licking the flap of an envelope. It was his invariable practice to write letters during the colonel's addresses, when once the serious business of line communications had been got through. Had he heard what had just been said? It was unlikely. The conference broke up soon afterwards, and in the mess anteroom, where a few officers had gathered for a drink before the evening meal, Thurston was confronted by an exuberant adjutant who at once bought him a drink. "Well, Tom," he said, "I reckon that fixes things up nice and neat." "I don't follow you, Bill." "Step number one in cooking your friend Dally's goose. Step number two will be on Monday, 09:30 hours, when I take the colonel round the line maintenance billet. You know what we'll find there, don't you?" Thurston stared blankly at the adjutant, whose eyes were sparkling like those of a child who's been promised a treat. "I still don't get you, Bill." "Use your loaf, Tommy. Dally's bloke's boudoir. Can't you imagine what it'll be like? There'll be dirt enough in there to raise a crop of potatoes, fag ends and night buckets all over the shop and the rest of it. The colonel will eat Dally for his lunch when he sees it." "Dally's got 3 days to get it cleaned up, though." "He would have if he paid attention to what his commanding officer says. But I know bloody well he was writing a letter when that warning was given. Serves the bastard right, do you see? He'll be off to the mysterious east before you can turn round." "How much does the colonel know about this?" "What I've told him." "You don't really think it'll work, do you?" "I know the old man. You don't, if you excuse my saying so." "It's a lousy trick, and you know it, Bill," Thurston said violently. "I think it's completely bloody." "Not at all. An officer who's bullshy enough to disobey a CO's order deserves all he gets," the adjutant said, looking sententious. "Coming in?" Still fuming, Thurston allowed himself to be led into the dining room. The massive green-tiled stove was working well, and the room was warm and cheerful. The house had belonged to the commandant of the Belgian military school. Its solid furniture and tenebrous landscape pictures had survived German occupation, though there was a large burn in the carpet that had been imputed, perhaps rightly, to the festivities of the Schutzstaffel. Jack Rowney, by importing photographs of popular entertainers, half-naked young women, and the commander-in-chief had done his best to document the colonel's thesis that the officers' mess was also their home. The adjutant, in excellent spirits, his hand on Thurston's shoulder, sent Corporal Gordon running for a bottle of Burgundy. Then, before they sat down, he looked very closely at Thurston. "Oh, and by the way, old boy," he said, a note of menace intensifying the quack in his voice, "you wouldn't think of tipping your friend Dally the wink about this little treat we've got lined up for him, would you? If you do, I'll have your guts for garters." Laughing heartily, he dug Thurston in the ribs and added, "Your leave's due at the end of the month, isn't it? Better watch out you don't make yourself indispensable here. We might not be able to let you go, do you see?" Early on Monday morning, Thurston was walking up from the signal office towards the area where the men's barracks rooms were. He was going to find his Batman and arrange to be driven some 20 miles to the department of the Advocate General's branch which handled divorce. The divorce in question was not his own, which would have to wait until after the war, but that of his section cook, whose wife had developed an immoderate fondness for RAF and USAAF personnel. Thurston was thinking less about the cook's wife than about the fateful inspection scheduled to take place any minute now. He realized he had timed things badly, but his trip had only just become possible, and he hoped to be out of the area before the colonel and the adjutant finished their task. He was keen to do this because the sight of a triumphant adjutant would be more than he could stand, especially since his conscience was very uneasy about the whole affair. There were all sorts of reasons why he should have tipped D'Alessio off about the inspection. The worst of it was, as he had realized in bed last night, when it was too late to do anything about it, that his irritation with D'Alessio over the matter of the Polish teleprinter had been a prime cause of his keeping quiet about it. He remembered actually thinking more than once that a thorough shaking up would do D'Alessio no harm, and that perhaps the son of an Italian cafe proprietor in Cascade, Glamorganshire, had certain disqualifications for the role of British regimental officer. He twisted up his face when he thought of this and started wondering just why it was that the adjutant was persecuting D'Alessio. Perhaps the latter's original offense had been his habit of doing bird warbles while the adjutant and Rowney listened to broadcast performances of the Warsaw Concerto, the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana, and other sub-classics dear to their hearts. Cheeping, trilling, and twittering, occasionally gargling like a seagull, D'Alessio had been told to shut up or get out, and had done neither. Thurston's way took him past the door of the notorious line maintenance billet. There seemed to be nobody about. Then he was startled by the sudden manifestation of two soldiers carrying brooms in a bucket. One of them had once been in his section and had been transferred early that year to one of the cable sections. He had forgotten which one. "Good morning, McLean," he said. The man addressed came sketchily to attention. "Morning, sir." "Getting on all right in number one company?" "Yes, thank you, sir. I like it fine." "Good. What are you fellows up to so early in the morning?" They looked at each other, and the other man said, "Cleaning up, sir. Fatigue party, sir." "I see. Right. Carry on." Thurston soon found his batman, who agreed with some reluctance to the proposed trip, and said he would see if he could get the jeep down to the signal office in 10 minutes. The jeep was a bone of contention between Thurston and his batman, and the batman always won, in the sense that he never in his life had he permitted Thurston to drive the jeep in his absence. He was within his rights, but Thurston often wished, as now, that he could be allowed a treat occasionally. He wished it more strongly when a jeep with no exhaust and with 7 men in it came bouncing down the track from the number one company billet area. They were laughing, and 2 of them were pretending to fight. The driver was a lance corporal. Suddenly, the laughing and fighting stopped, and the men assumed an unnatural sobriety. The reason for this was provided by the immediate emergence into the view of the colonel and the adjutant moving across Thurston's front. They saw him at once. He hastily saluted, and the adjutant, as usual, returned the salute. His gaze met Thurston's under lowered brows, and his lips were gathered in the fiercest scowl they were capable of. Thurston waited until they were out of sight and hurried to the door of the lane maintenance billet. The place was deserted. Except in illustrations to army manuals and the like, he had never seen such perfection of order and cleanliness. It was obviously the result of hours of devoted labor. He leaned against the doorpost and began to laugh. "I gather the plot against our pal Dally misfired somewhat," Bentham said in the mess dining room later that day. Thurston looked up rather wearily. His jeep had broken down on the way back from the divorce expert, and his return had been delayed for some hours. He had made part of the journey on the back of a motorbike. Further, he had just read a unit order requiring him to make the jeep available at the orderly room the next morning. It wasn't his turn yet. The adjutant had struck again. "You know, I'm quite pleased," Bentham went on, lighting a cigarette and moving towards the stove where Thurston stood. "Oh, so am I." "You are? Now that's rather interesting. Surprising, even. I should have thought you'd be downcast." Something in his tone made Thurston glance at him sharply and put down the unit order. Bentham was standing with his feet apart in an intent attitude. "Why should you think that, Ben?" "I'll tell you. Glad of the opportunity. First of all, I'll tell you why it misfired, if you don't already know. Because I tipped Dally off. Lent him some of my blokes and all to get the place spick and span." Thurston nodded, thinking of the 2 men he had seen outside the billet that morning. "I see." "You do you? Good. Now I'll tell you why I did it. First of all, the army's not the place for this kind of plotting and scheming. The job's too important. Secondly, I did it because I don't like seeing an able man taken down by a bunch of ignorant, jumped-up, so-called bloody gentlemen from the territorial army. Not that I hold any brief for Delasio outside his technical abilities. As you know, I'm a regular soldier, and I disapprove most strongly of anything damn slovenly. It's part of my nature now, and I don't mind, either. But one glance at the adjutant's face when he was telling me the form for this morning, and I knew where my duty lay. I hope I always do. I do my best to play it his way as a rule for the sake of peace and quiet. But this business was different, wasn't it? Thurston had lowered his gaze. Yes, Ben. It came as a bit of shock to me, you know, to find that Delasio needed tipping off. How do you mean? I mean that I'd have expected someone else to have told him already. I only heard about this last night. I was the only one here later on, and I suppose the adjutant felt he had to tell someone. I should have thought by that time someone else would have let the cat out of the bag to dally. You, for instance, you were in on this from the start, weren't you? Thurston said nothing. I've no doubt you have your reasons, your excuses for not letting on, in spite of the fact that I've always understood you were the great one for pouring scorn on the adjutant and Rowney and Cleaver and the rest of that crowd. Yes, you could talk about them till you were black in the face, but when it came to doing something, talking where it would do some good, you kept your mouth shut. And, if I remember rightly, you were the one who used to stick up for Dally when the others were laying into him behind his back. You know what I think? I don't think you care tuppence. You don't care beyond talking any road. I think you're really quite sold on the adjutant's crowd. Never mind what you say about them. Chew that over, and chew this over and all. I think you're a bastard, just like the rest of them. Tell that to your friend the adjutant, Captain Bloody Thurston. Thurston stood there for some time after Bentham had gone, tearing up the unit order and throwing the pieces into the stove. And that story was My Enemy's Enemy by Kingsley Amis from Treasury of Great Short Stories, published by Amaranth Press. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. A Bit of String by Guy de Maupassant. Along all the roads leading to Goderville, the peasants and their wives were going toward the town, for it was market day. The men walked at an easy pace, the whole body thrown ahead at each movement of the long, crooked legs, men deformed by rude labor, by guiding the plow, which at once forces the right shoulder upward and twists the waist, by reaping, which spreads the knees, for solid footing, by all the patient and painful toil of the country. Their blue blouses, glossy with starch, as though varnished, ornamented at the neck and wrists by a simple pattern in white, swelled out round their bony chests, like captive balloons from which heads, arms, and legs were protruding. Some were leading by a cord a cow or a calf, and their wives behind the animals were hastening their pace by the strokes of branches stripped of their leaves. The women carried on their arms great baskets, out of which hung, here and there, heads of chickens or ducks. They walked with shorter steps than their husbands, and at a more rapid pace, spare, erect, and wrapped in scant shawls pinned across their flat chests, their heads enveloped in white linen drawn closely over the hair and surmounted by a bonnet. Now a pleasure wagon passed at a jerky pony trot, shaking fantastically two men seated side by side, and a woman at the back of the vehicle holding on to its sides to soften the hard jolts. In the square of Goderville was a crowd, a jam of mingled human beings and beasts. The horns of cattle, the high hats of the rich farmers, and the headdresses of the women emerged from the surface of the assembly, and discordant voices, clamorous, bawling, kept up a continuous and savage babble, overtopped now and then by a shout from the robust lungs of a merry countryman, or the lowing of a cow attached to the wall of a house. All this mass was redolent of the stable and soilure, of milk, of hay, of sweat, and diffused that rank, penetrating odor, human and bestial, peculiar to people of the fields. Master Hochkorn of Breite had just arrived at Goderville, and was going toward the square when he saw on the ground a bit of string. Master Hochkorn, an economist, like every true Norman, thought that anything might be of use worth picking up, and he bent down painfully, for he suffered from rheumatism. He took up the piece of string and was winding it carefully when he noticed Maladine, the harness maker, watching him from his doorway. The two men had long ago had a quarrel about a halter, and both, being vindictive, had remained unfriendly. Hochkorn was seized with a kind of shame at thus being seen by his enemy picking up a bit of twine out of the mud. He quickly hid his prize under his blouse, then in his breeches pocket. Then he pretended to search the ground again for something which he did not find, and he went off toward the market, his head in advance, bent double by his infirmities. He was forthwith lost in the noisy, shuffling crowd, everywhere in motion from innumerable buyings and sellings. The peasants examined the cows, went away, came back, hesitated, always fearful of being outwitted, never daring to decide, peering into the face of the vendor, endlessly searching to discover the ruse in the man and the fault in the beast. The women, putting their great baskets down at their feet, had drawn out their fowls, which were lying on the ground, legs bound, eyes wild, combs scarlet. They listened to offers, held their prices unmoved, their faces inscrutable, or, suddenly deciding to accept an offer, cried out to the would-be purchaser slowly moving away. "Agreed, Master Houtin, I will give it at your price." Then little by little the square emptied, and the angelus-sounding noon, those who lived too far to go home dispersed in the various public houses. At Jourdain's the great dining hall was full of feasters, as the vast court was full of vehicles of every pedigree, carts, gigs, tilburies, pleasure vans, carrioles innumerable, yellow with mud, mended, out of order, lifting to heaven their shafts like two arms or nosing the ground, rear in the air. Opposite the tables of diners, the great chimney-piece, full of bright flame, threw a lively warmth on the backs of the row at the right. Three spits were turning, weighted with chickens, pigeons, and legs of mutton, and a delectable odor of roast flesh and of juice streaming over its golden brown skin, escaped from the hearth, put everyone in gay humor, and made mouths water. All the aristocracy of the plough dined there with Master Jourdain, innkeeper and horse-dealer, a shrewd fellow who had his dollars. The platters were passed and emptied, as were the tankards of yellow cider. Each one talked of his affairs, his purchases, his sales. The harvest was discussed. The weather was good for grass, but a little sharp for grain. All at once the drums sounded in the court before the house. All save a few indifferent fellows were quickly on their feet and running to the door or the windows, their mouths full, their napkins in their hands. When he had finished his roulade, the public crier held forth in a jerky voice, cutting his phrases at the wrong place. "It is made known to the inhabitants of Goderville, and in general to all, the people present at the market, that there was lost this morning on Bensville Road between 9 and 10 o'clock, a wallet containing 500 francs and important papers. You are asked to return it to the town hall without delay, or to the house of Master Fortuné Ulbrecht of Manville. There will be 20 francs reward." Then the crier went on. One heard once more, far off, the muffled beating of his drum, and his voice enfeebled by the distance. Then they all began to talk of the event, estimating Master Holbrecht's chances of finding or not finding his wallet. And the meal went on. They were finishing their coffee when the chief of police appeared at the door. "Where is Master Hochkorn of Braute?" he asked. Hochkorn, seated at the farther end of the table, replied, "I'm here." The chief proceeded. "Master Hochkorn, will you have the kindness to accompany me to the town hall? The mayor wishes to speak with you." The countryman, surprised and disquieted, emptied at a draught his little glass of rum, arose, and still more bent than in the morning, for the first movement after each relaxation was particularly difficult, he set out, repeating, "I'm here, I'm here," and he followed the chief. The mayor was waiting for him, seated in his fauteuil. He was a notary of the vicinity, a big, solemn man of pompous phrases. "Master Hochkorn," said he, "you were seen to pick up on the Bensville Road this morning the wallet lost by Master Holbrecht of Manville." The peasant, astonished, looked at the mayor, frightened already, without knowing why, by the suspicion which had fallen on him. "What? What? I picked up the wallet?" "Yes, you yourself." "Word of honor, I didn't even know of it. You were seen." "Seen? What? Who saw me?" "Monsieur Maladin, the harness maker." Then the old man remembered, understood, and reddened with anger. "He saw me, that lot. He saw me pick up that string. See here, Monsieur Mayor, and feeling in the bottom of his pocket, he drew out the bit of cord. But the mayor, incredulous, shook his head. You won't make me believe, Master Hochkorn, that Maladine, who is a man worthy of credence, took that thread for a wallet. The peasant, furious, raised his hand, spit, to attest his innocence, and declared, Yet it's the truth of God, the sacred truth, Monsieur Mayor. On my soul and my salvation, I repeat it. The mayor continued, After picking up the object, you went on searching in the mud a long time to see if some piece of money mightn't have escaped you. The old man gasped with indignation and fear. May one tell lies like that to injure an honest man? May one say? His protest was vain. He was not believed. He was confronted with Monsieur Maladine, who repeated and sustained his former affirmation. For an hour the two men hurled insults at each other. Hochkorn was searched at his demand, and nothing was found on him. Finally the mayor, greatly perplexed, sent him away, warning him that he should inform the council and await orders. The news spread. When he came out of the town hall, the old man was surrounded and questioned with a curiosity serious or mocking, but with no ill will in it. He began to recount the story of the string, but no one believed him. They only laughed. He went on, stopped by everybody, stopping his acquaintances, beginning anew his tale and his protestations, turning his pockets inside out to prove that he had nothing. "Move on, old quibbler," they said to him. And he became angry, exasperated, feverish, sick at heart, at not being believed. He did not know what to do, but told his story over and over. Night came. It was time to go home. He set out with three of his neighbors, to whom he pointed out the place where he had picked up the bit of cord, and all the way home he talked of his adventure. In the evening he made a circuit of the village of Braute to tell to everybody. He met only incredulity. He was ill all night from his trouble. The next day, toward 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Marius Pomay, a farmhand of Emenville, to return the wallet and its contents to Monsieur Hollebrecht of Maniville. The man stated in effect that he had found the wallet in the road, but not knowing how to read, had taken it home to his employer. The news spread all about. Master Hochkorn was told of it. He at once set out again on his travels and began to narrate his story, completed by the denouement. He was triumphant. "It's not the thing that grieved me most, you understand," he said, "but it's the lie. Nothing harms you like being charged with a lie." All day long he talked of his adventure. He told it on the streets to men passing, in the taverns to men drinking, after church the next Sunday. He stopped strangers to tell it to them. Now he was tranquil, yet something half disturbed him, without his knowing exactly what. People had an amused air as they listened to him. They did not appear convinced. He thought he detected whispers behind his back. Tuesday of the following week he betook himself to the market of Goderville, driven there by the need of exploiting his case. Maladine, standing in his doorway, began to laugh when he saw him passing. Why? He accosted a farmer of Criquetot, who did not let him finish, but, giving him a blow in the pit of his stomach, cried in his face, "Go your way, humbug!" Master Hochkorn was dumbfounded and more ill at ease. Why had he been called a humbug? When he was seated at table in Jourdain's Inn, he again began to explain the affair. A jockey of Montivier cried to him, "Come, come, old croaker, I know about your string." Hochkorn stammered, "But since it is found, the wallet?" The other answered, "Hold your tongue, father. One finds, another returns. I know nothing about it, but I implicate you." The peasant was left choking. He understood at last. He was accused of having returned the wallet through an accomplice. He tried to protest. The whole table began to laugh. He could not finish his dinner and went out in the midst of mockeries. He returned home ashamed and disgraced, strangling with rage and confusion, so much the more overwhelmed, in that he was capable, with his Norman duplicity, of doing the very thing of which he was accused, and even boasting of it as a good stroke. Confusedly, he saw his innocence impossible to prove, his chicanery being well known, and he felt himself cut to the heart by the injustice of the suspicion. Then he commenced again to recount his adventure, lengthening each day his story, adding each time new reasonings, more energetic protestations, more solemn oaths, which he invented and arranged in his hours of solitude, his mind occupied solely with the story of the string. He was believed the less in proportion to the complication of his defense and the subtlety of his argument. That's the reasoning of a liar, they said behind his back. He felt it, spent himself, wore his life out in useless efforts. He wasted away visibly. Wags now made him tell the string for their amusement, as one makes a soldier who has fought recount his battle. His mind, harassed and unsettled, grew feeble. Toward the end of December he took to his bed. He died early in January, and in the delirium of his agony he attested his innocence, repeating, "A little string, a little string. Wait, here it is, Monsieur Mayor." And that story was The Bit of String by Guy de Maupassant, from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44, from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. The Peaches of August by Toy Derricote. The long-awaited here at the local farm stand are not as comely as the ones at Whole Foods, but they are dollars cheaper, and so we sweep them up like sweepstakes winners and stack them gently in our purposeful cloth bags. Tomorrow one of us, before the other awakens, will slice into Tupperware the four or five softest to the fingers, to test press kindly as a newborn's cheek, and stir them with brown sugar from the box sitting atop the refrigerator for months, alone, remote, mysterious. That's the end of our classic and contemporary short stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.